Originally, when I met with the TAs, we had plans for exam 2 to be ready to hand back to you. I don't know what happened. I'm afraid out to decide who was grading what over the weekend. I don't know. I'll probably see a bunch of dead bodies up in the office. At any rate, sorry, and I will see if I can get them for you by Thursday. You know, given that you've gone a while without those exams in your hands, I went ahead and planned to give you another one. So don't mind the guy behind the curtain. So exam 3 actually is a week from Thursday. It will be here during your lecture time, and it will cover basically up through the stuff we did last class and what I'll do at the start of this class. So that'll be up through electromagnetic waves, but not including polarization or optics, which I'll be doing today. So it'll be up through this week's workshop and this week's problem. And I'll be having to go out of town Wednesday, so I'm going to have a Q&A session Tuesday, but I'll have to figure out when to prepare and all of that. Okay? All right. I know it seems like a lot of exams, but whenever that thought crosses your mind, just remember that that's part of the package deal of having to draw. I have to have three exams.
I could have done one exam and a drop, but I thought that might be a little stressful for some of you. So, anyway, any questions? I think the formula sheet will pretty much be the same drill. So, okay. So let me very quickly review what we were doing last time. So we've been talking about electromagnetic waves, and Maxwell's equations basically are always true. One of the things that comes out of them, in particular if you look to solve them under the circumstances when the source is very far away, then you get a particular solution that I think is intuitively very useful. And in this solution, the electric field and the magnetic field are both harmonic functions, sines or cosines. In this particular setup, I have them traveling along the x direction, which you can tell in part because if you look at the argument of the harmonic function, it's kx minus omega t. So k is 2 pi over the wavelength, so this gives you periodicity in space. Omega is 2 pi over the period, that gives you periodicity in time. E and B are in phase. What I mean by that is if E is 0, B is 0, and the D is growing to maximum, B is growing to maximum exactly the same way. And you can tell that because these arguments are the same. E and B are transverse to the direction of motion. All right. So if it's propagating in the x direction, note that E and B are along the y and z. Note that E is perpendicular to B. They have an amplitude that is correlated. That is, B's amplitude is just the amplitude of B divided by C. And you get a picture of them. You can think of them traveling as harmonic waves perpendicular to one another. And this pattern is moving then at the speed of light along the x direction. And if I were to freeze time and you look everywhere in the infinite plane that's parallel to the YZ plane here, you would find E everywhere in that plane with this magnitude and B everywhere in that plane with that magnitude and direction. Okay? So it's not that the light in this solution is confined to a small region transversely. It is a plane wave that's propagating, and these represent the magnitudes of the fields and the directions of the fields in that entire plane. And you can calculate in this solution the speed of the phenomenon, and it goes to the speed of light. So we talked fairly quickly about a number of characteristics of electromagnetic waves last time. We looked at the energy in an electromagnetic wave that passes, say, a plane in space. You know, if we make a box in space and allow the electromagnetic wave to go through it, we can actually calculate the energy at any given moment because we know that the electric field and the magnetic field actually carry energy. So I don't know that I had a I don't remember if I completed this thought with you last time or not, but remember that when we invented the electric field and the magnetic field as conceptual tools that turned out to be sort of mathematically useful, that are sort of convenient. They're a way of thinking about the force that you have between two particles. Okay, it's just a conceptual tool for that. Now we have a situation where when we look at Maxwell's equations, we have the electric field inducing a magnetic field, which induces an electric field of self-coupling, and you get this weird phenomenon of an electromagnetic wave where it travels. So it's hard to think of these fields as being fictitious anymore. Okay, because they carry energy, and you have this interesting phenomenon called light. So I think that's sort of cool, actually. So there's some reality to this EMD, even though they sort of came out in a way that nobody would have imagined could lead to this. So they carry energy, and we can calculate by looking at the energy density as a function of time, we can calculate the intensity, which is the power per unit area of the electromagnetic wave, and that turns out to be E times B over mu, and you can rewrite E and B in terms of using this relationship between E and B if you wish. So you can do this in terms of E squared or B squared. Because the energy is flowing with a specific direction, we actually create something which is sort of a directional intensity. That is, you know, the brightness of the wave, the intensity of the wave, and in the direction of motion. And we call that vector the pointing vector. It goes E cross B, so you can always tell the direction of the electromagnetic wave because it is in the direction of E cross B. It's called the pointing vector. I actually spelled this way. I think that's for a person, but it's sort of a silly way to remember the thing because it's basically pointing in the direction of the energy flow. S is an intensity. What's usually important is the time average of that intensity because most things don't happen on the speed with which the electromagnetic waves oscillate. And so when you calculate that, you can rewrite it in terms of E's or B's, etc. And in this case, we have E0, B0. Those are the amplitudes. Over here, when we say E and B, those are the instantaneous E and B. You can also write this in terms of amplitudes if you wish, but you have to remember that you have to time average it to do that. Doesn't really matter, but these are useful formulas, so I'm throwing them up there again. Turns out that we looked at sort of a plausibility argument that electromagnetic waves can exert a force on a particle. So they carry momentum, and that momentum goes as the energy divided by C.
And we looked at the force that they can exert using dimensional arguments last time, and we found that the force that an electromagnetic wave would exert if it were completely absorbed. So there are ways, the standard way, well, there are two ways typically, that in some physics problem on an exam or a GRE or MCAT or whatever will tell you that the electromagnetic wave is completely absorbed. It can say the electromagnetic wave is completely absorbed. The other way is it can say an electromagnetic wave is incident on something that is black. Okay, if it is black, the wave is completely absorbed. So that's another way they say it. If it is reflected, if it is completely reflected, then they will tell you, you know, a perfectly silvered surface or a mylar sheet, which is some material that's usually silvered, something like that. Or they'll tell you it's totally reflected. At any rate, just like if you were doing basic mechanics and throwing a basketball between two people. If you catch the basketball, there'll be a certain transfer of momentum. But if you put your arms up, it bounces off you, the transfer of momentum to you is twice as much because you have to reverse the momentum of the basketball if it reflects off you. Exactly the same thing happens with light. So if it's fully absorbed, the radiation pressure, the force per unit area, goes as the intensity divided by C. And if it's totally reflected, that's multiplied by 2. And so I talked a little last time about how important this is for stars. I'm not going to bother repeating that. Here's a graphic of an artist's conception of a solar sail. So there's actually a little spacecraft right here, but it kicks out this big mylar sail. And quite literally, you can sail using light because of the radiation pressure of the light against that reflected surface. Okay, so this is going to be what I consider the end of material for exam 3. And basically it's through the material in chapter 31. Okay? Now, I'm going to keep talking for a little while about electromagnetic waves. I'm going to talk about polarization. I believe your textbook polarization is covered in another chapter, and quite simply, I couldn't get quite far enough to put it on exam 3. So specifically, polarization and anything about polarization is not going to be on the exam. All right, so let me just quickly remind you of this picture. Any electromagnetic wave has an electric component and a magnetic component. They're right angles to each other, and they're in phase. And when I draw them, I have been drawing them sort of like this. And I remind you, this in particular is probably one of the places where it is most useful to look at these visualizations that I have up on the web. So you can get a sense of what the moving wave is like. And remember, don't be fooled by thinking it's transversely contained. These represent full planes, like this yellow thing. These vectors represent this field inside that entire plane. Okay? So that is the picture of the electromagnetic wave. That particular wave is really a special choice in that we have chosen a solution of this plane wave from far away where we have constrained the electric field to be along the y-axis. If you were to go back when I was sort of setting that up, I told you that I made a special choice there. So that's what I have drawn here. Okay? It didn't have to be that way. So if we're going to discuss what is called the polarization of electric waves, of electromagnetic waves, we need to allow for a more general case and not constrain the electric field to be along the y-axis. Because what we mean when we talk about polarization is what is the orientation of the electric field in the electromagnetic wave. You might think, why electric field instead of magnetic field? That's really convention, because if I set one of them, the other one is determined. And so it allows me to basically give you an orientation for the electromagnetic wave. And if you notice in the demo that we did in class last time, I had an electromagnetic wave that's created with an electric field oscillating here. And when I had the bulb with a wire set up so that the electric field could oscillate along the wire, the bulb would be bright, and when I turned it at right angles, the electric field was no longer oscillating in a way that would excite the current through the bulb, and the bulb was off. So the polarization matters, okay? And so this is important. And the problem with the picture that I have right here is that I have chosen the polarization. I have told you the orientation of the electric field line. So we need a more general solution in order to really talk about polarization.
So you've all had calculus, so you've probably heard of something called a basis set. So I want to imagine having an electromagnetic wave where I have the electric field oscillating this way, and I guess I don't remember what I had up here. Yeah, I have it oscillating along the Y. So this is basically the electric field component of the wave that we've just been talking about. Okay? I could imagine having a different wave where the electric field is this way instead. And this case, this is the positive x-axis going that way. So this thing is now polarized along the x-axis instead of the y-axis. You okay with that? These two electric components of these two electric waves, I'm not drawing the magnetic components right now. Assume they are there. Note that these are what you would in mathematics call orthogonal waves. The electric fields of these two waves are at right angles to one another. Okay? If you, in mathematics, consider this a basis set, it basically says that I can make any general orientation of electric field by superimposing a solution that includes some of this and some of that. Right? If you want to think about it, if I have two vectors that are at right angles to one another, okay, I can take some fraction of this one and add it to some fraction of that one to come up with a vector that's in any direction I wish in that. Okay? So I can take any vector, well, you've been doing it since start of physics 113. I have a vector, what do? You resolve it into x and y components. The x and y components of that vector are a basis set for it. Okay, so these are two orthogonal solutions to the plane, electromagnetic plane wave, and we're going to use them as a basis set from which we can construct any electric field orientation that we would like to have. That electric field orientation is the polarization. Now the reason I'm sort of going crazy with this on you right now is that each of these are basically legitimate solutions to the electromagnetic plane wave that's coming at you, or going that way. Each of them comes with a magnetic component that's at right angles to it, and a cross B goes in the direction the wave is going, etc., etc. I'm not going to draw the magnetic components anymore. Instead, I'm going to look at these two electric components and how they add together. So it can be pretty confusing when you go back and look at your notes if you don't realize that. So here I'm looking at the electric field only of two orthogonal solutions to the electromagnetic plane wave, if you will. And I will consider these to form a basis set. And now what I'd like to do is to begin to combine, looking at these two different solutions, I want to combine them so that we can see what happens with the electric wave. So let us imagine that we have, and now just to make things completely confusing, I'm going to change coordinates for you. So I'm going to put, this is the x direction, this is the y direction, this will be the z direction. Now, let me just basically add these two waves together just like they are with the same amplitude. In which case, I will have one that does this. Well, if you don't mind the fact that I changed the names of the axes. So this would be the electric field for one of the orthogonal components of the electromagnetic wave. I could imagine having the other one that would look something like this. And what I'd like you to imagine is that your eyeball is right here. The z-axis is going right through your eye, and your eye, for magical reasons, is sensitive to the electric field vector as this thing is passing through your eye. Okay? And I want you to imagine what your eyeball would see at the very moment. Remember, this wave is going this way. What would your eyeball see at the very moment that this piece of the wave is passing through your eye? The electric field for one of the components is straight up. The other one is straight this way. Vector superposition, you add them together. That is, your eye automatically does that. So what your eye would see is an electric field that is the sum of those two vectors. So it would be at 45 degrees. Okay? As this wave passes through your eye, each of these vectors gets smaller. Like that. Which means what your eye sees is a vector that's at 45 degrees that just gets smaller, smaller and smaller until this part of the wave is at your eye, in which case there is no electric field vector. Then this part of the wave starts going through your eye, and now note that E and the two E's are now growing like this. So your eye sees a vector that goes from here to zero, back down to here, and then back up. So it's oscillating here. Okay? We call that kind of thing linear polarization because the electric field vector is oscillating along a line. Okay? So what you see is the electric field line doing this. And this is linear polarization. And you would be looking at it such that the positive x-axis is this way, the positive y-axis would look like that to your eyeball. Okay? As that electromagnetic wave passes through your eye, it is a linearly polarized plane wave. The electric field is oscillating like this. You can decompose it into the two orthogonal waves, which have the same amplitude. Right? Same thing. We're going to have the same first wave like we did up above. And the solution for that one, say E, let's see, I called that dx. Okay, up here, E is in the x, and it's E0x times cosine kx minus omega t. We're superimposing that with E in the y, which is equal to same amplitude, E0x times the cosine of kx minus omega t. The top one is along the X hat. The bottom one is along the Y hat. Now what I'm doing is I will keep the top one the same, but what I want to do is to make the bottom one, I want to add to it a phase angle of pi. That is, I'm just taking the other one and I shift it by one pi. It's a half a wavelength. And so to do that, it will start out at zero when the other one is at maximum amplitude. It will come up to maximum amplitude when the other one is zero, and it goes to zero when the other one is maximum amplitude. It goes to maximum amplitude when the other one is zero, etc. So now, what do you see when you look at this thing? Now you'll notice, as you're looking at it, when this part of the wave passes through, the electric field is just orange, and the blue has gone to zero. I didn't quite draw it that way. Let me start here. Let's suppose the wave is right here and is passing through your eye. Okay, so it's going this way. At that very instant right here, the blue is zero and the orange is maximal, straight here. Okay? As it passes through, okay, the orange is becoming smaller, but the blue is growing this way. Okay? So you start out with a vector that's completely down. As the wave passes through, this becomes a little shorter, this one starts to come out, and you'll begin to get a vector that is pointing, instead of straight down, it's now pointing like that. The wave goes through a little bit more, the orange one becomes a little less, the blue one becomes a little bit more, the superposition vector looks like that. You reach the point where you're right here, the blue is now, let's see, right here, the orange now is zero, and you're completely that way. So that superposition vector rotates like this as the wave goes through your eye. And that's what we call circular polarization. Okay? And as you look at it, it's rotating for you counterclockwise. Okay? Which I believe we call left-handed polarization. I shifted by pi over 2, sorry. If I shifted by a full pi, which is not what I drew, then you have this one. And by full pi, then the other one is at full amplitude over here. That didn't go so well. And basically what you'll get if you look at that is that instead of what we first saw, the vector doing this, it'll now do this. Okay, so you'll have linear polarization again, but the angle of the polarization is now shifted. All right, this is hard to draw. It's hard to visualize, okay? So I have the world's greatest visualization here for you. And this you may want to play with to begin to get some of this stuff. All right. So what I have initially is the first picture that I drew for you. What you see up here is the purple is the vector superposition of the electric fields that you have. In this case, I have no phase angle between the two. 0 degree phase angle. So you have linear polarization at 45 degrees. I can set this up so that the path is preserved a little bit, so you sort of see where the vector has been. Okay, if I now shift by pi, which is going to be 180 degrees, you get the last thing I just showed you. And look at what happens when I shift. All I did was I shifted one of these solutions relative to the other by a half a wavelength. The real fun happens when you go to pi over 2, which was sort of the second thing I showed you. So it would be 90 degrees. So now these are the same as we had, except this is now 90 degrees. And see what happens with the superposition vector. Your eyeball's here, and you see what's going on. If instead of plus 90 degrees, I go to minus 90 degrees, note that the solution is the same, but it's going to rotate the opposite direction. So you have handedness with circular polarization. If it rotates clockwise as it's coming at you, you call it right-handed. If it rotates clockwise, counterclockwise, you call it left-handed polarization. I can change the amplitudes of the two orthogonal solutions a little bit. And then you get elliptical polarization. I can change the phase angle a bit more. And now you can get elliptical, that would be linear again. I can rotate the ellipse. You gotta admit this is pretty cool. Okay? Now you might ask, okay, that's really cool. The app is awesome. But why do I really give a crap? Okay. So there are some reasons why you might give a crap, but one of them is I'm sure you've done diagnostics in chemistry, which had to do with how the light is rotated by different molecules. Okay? And that turns out to be really important. We're going to talk about it shortly, but as you know, the strength of the electric field and magnetic field varies when you go through materials, and you know that we calculated the speed of light as 1 over the square root of epsilon naught u naught. When you go in materials, you don't have an epsilon naught and u naught anymore, but you're in the material, so you have an epsilon and a mu. Okay? That means the speed of light of something in material is different from what it is in a vacuum. It's slower. Okay, and we measure that by the index of refraction. So we'll be talking about that. But one of the things that's really cool about different materials is that they can have, and some of them can have an epsilon and a mu that's different in, say, one direction than it is in another direction.
which means if I have light unpolarized, or if I have light, say, of orientation with the electric field this way and one that way, as they pass through the material, you may find one of these orientations moves slower than the other, for example. And if that were to happen, you might take linear polarization because they're in phase, and it might get converted into circular polarization because you've slowed one of these things down a little relative to the other. So real materials can affect polarization, and you can use that as a diagnostic in a lot of ways. So I do strongly encourage you to play with this thing, which is linked on your class website, actually, because I can't do it justice drawing. Okay. So suppose that I have light that is unpolarized. So you imagine light coming out of an incandescent bulb. It's created by whatever, the process, all sorts of processes that have all random orientations. So the electric field basically comes out, even if you're far away, then you have maybe a plane wave solution. But the electric field basically comes out with all sorts of polarizations. That's a way to think about it. So you can imagine linear polarization in every which direction for the plane wave that's coming at something. Then you can have materials that cut out, that absorb the light if it's polarized one way and not if it's polarized another way. So the standard material is Polaroid film. Okay? And just like your sunglasses. So what happens is that, let's say we start out with an intensity, I'll call I0, of randomly polarized wave. And if we pass it through a Polaroid filter, which I'm going to represent by lines going one direction, and a way to think about it when I draw it this way, is it will only allow light that has a polarization along those lines to pass through. Chemically, you get organic molecules that absorb the light in such a way that you put them sort of linear and they'll manage to absorb one polarization versus another. But when that happens, what you'll get is light with a polarization that passes through, and it turns out that the intensity you get when you cut out all the other components and only allow the components through this way is 1/2. One half the initial intensity going into the polarizer. So, in fact, one of the reasons Polaroid sunglasses are nice is regardless of what, if you have randomly polarized light coming at you, it'll cut the intensity by a factor of 2. Okay, so that's one good thing about it. Yeah.
How could it only be cutting it down by a half when it's actually filtering out every orientation except for...
Well, it allows that one through. For this one, it will allow that component through. Right? So everything contributes except for the thing that's exactly at right angles to the allowed direction. But as you change the angle, you're letting smaller and smaller components through. So you're breaking it up. And I'm not proving this to you, but mathematically, when you work it out, it ends up being half the intensity. So let's say that I have randomly oriented light coming at you, intensity I0. Then I polarize it along a certain direction. So I now will have an intensity of 1/2 I0. And now let's say that I pass it through yet another polarizer, but that polarizer is at some angle with respect to the first one, which I'll call theta. Now, if I have a vector that is like so, and I have something here that's at an angle theta, I can break that vector up into components. This component of it is the piece that gets through, and that's going to be let's say this is E, sorry. So this is the electric field that gets through when you polarize it. This piece is going to be E times cosine of theta, and intensity goes as E squared. So the intensity that you get when you get to the other side here is the intensity that you have at this point, which is 1/2 times I0 times cosine squared of theta.
The cosine basically is projecting out that piece of the electric field that comes through at the new angle. You square it because intensity goes as electric field squared. So if you were to analyze this wave using Polaroid film, for example, the first one would give you half the intensity, then the second one would give you that intensity times cosine squared, where cosine squared is the angle you choose. Cosine is an angle that starts out with an amplitude of 1, 0, and then as I go to 90 degrees, it goes to 0. So what this tells you is if I have that second film, and I put it at 90 degrees to the first one, no light will come through. Okay? So now I have two Polaroid films that are oriented along each other. I'm now going to rotate one of them slowly from being along to 90 degrees and look at. And you can see the light that comes through. Now as I rotate it, it gets darker and darker because this cosine squared term is kicking in. And when this top one is at 90 degrees to the first one, I have no light passing through, except where, yeah, don't worry about that little piece right here because I have some strange overlap or something going here. Anyway, as I continue to turn it and I keep going the same direction I was, as I come back in alignment, the electric field comes through is the same. Okay? If I put a third one, something in the middle, you basically have the same thing. And the intensity doesn't really change because I haven't cut out any of the electric field in addition. Alright? So that's why, as it's going in, the intensity is not very different. You'll lose a little bit of absorption in the film, so it's just slightly different, but basically it's different. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the top one, I'm going to turn so that it is at right angles to the bottom one, and no light gets through. Okay? And now I'm going to insert one in the middle. I have one that's oriented one way, one that's oriented the other way, so no polarization, no light gets through. Okay? I'm going to, in the middle, insert something that's at 45 degrees to both of them. If I insert it all the way through, you see the full circle. But you can see up above, no light is getting through. But where that intermediate filter, or the, where that intermediate polarite is, you get light. Now all of a sudden you get light. What's going on?
I have a Polaroid filter like this. I have one that's at right angles to it. And now I put something at 45 degrees, and suddenly you see something. I've unpolarized light. That allows a component like this to come through. If I don't have the middle piece, then that piece completely cuts it out, because the first light coming through is polarized like this. The second filter is at 90 degrees to it, so it totally cuts it out. Right? But if I insert this filter at 45 degrees with some loss in intensity, it allows light through that has that angle. And now I have a non-zero angle, right? I have this. This thing is the one at 90 degrees, so I now have a non-zero component that can go through this one. So it'll end up with a little bit of light like that. Does that make sense? And you can calculate how much that is, because you get, you know, a drop in intensity by a factor of 2, because you go from fully unpolarized to polarized one direction. Then, relative to that, this is at some angle, so that intensity gets multiplied by cosine squared of that angle. Then, relative to that, this one is at some angle, so you multiply it by cosine squared of that angle. And that, then, is the final intensity that you end up with. Any questions? So the real power of Polaroid sunglasses, and I almost hesitate to tell you this because I'm likely to cause one of you to have a car crash. The real power of Polaroid sunglasses is you have unpolarized light coming from some source, some other car's headlights or the sun or whatever, okay? And let's say that light is propagating, and let's say that it hits a puddle of water. And then that light gets reflected off the water, like so. But one of the things that we see when we look at the polarization of light upon reflection, it is the light of a certain orientation of polarization that gets reflected with a higher efficiency than the other. So it turns out that the light that's reflected off the puddle will have an orientation like so. So reflected light is polarized. So if I have a pair of Polaroid sunglasses and I orient the Polaroid in my sunglasses like that, it will eliminate the reflected light. But unreflected light, unpolarized light, the intensity will come through the half. Which means you put on your sunglasses and you cut the intensity of everything by half, but if the light is reflected and fully polarized, it's gone. Okay? Yeah.
But if you tilt your head while you're driving...
That's why I'm going to cause you to wreck. Exactly. So if you do this, you'll see the reflected light with full intensity. And if you take your friend's sunglasses, okay, and you've got yours on like this, all right, and you take theirs and you do that in front of you, you'll have black, right? You're cutting everything out. So I actually strongly recommend that you be the passenger and take the driver's sunglasses and screw around with those, okay? But it's a lot of fun, actually. And yes, I have totally been at stoplight, well, someone's been driving and done exactly that just to see. It's sort of cool. It really works. So that's the power, though. So when this, if it's a, I mean, I do strongly recommend Polaroid sunglasses, and the reason is because it will preferentially cut out the glare, which is what they advertise. So the glare coming off of somebody's back windshield toward you totally gets cut out with the Polaroid sunglasses. Not completely, but you know, to a large extent. Very cool. Yes. Any questions? Comments? All right. So that is really the end of electromagnetic waves, but the polarization piece is not going to be on this exam. It'll be covered on the final. So. You can take Maxwell's equations and you can derive all the stuff that we're about to do. And the stuff that we're about to do, I'm not going to do that extraction for you from Maxwell's equations, but we call this geometrical optics, or geometric optics. Some of you have probably seen this kind of stuff before. In fact, with much of the class from here on out, a lot of the pieces of it you'll have seen before. So things will sort of speed up a bit. We'll be doing somewhat disjoint topics a bit faster than we have been in the past. So, as we mentioned, in a vacuum, C is 1 over epsilon naught mu naught. If we are in a material, you'll have a velocity, and that is less than C. And we define the index of refraction to be the speed of light divided by the velocity in the material. The speed of light in a vacuum divided by the velocity in the material itself. So you certainly can go faster than the speed of light if you are in a material. Okay, that's something people really don't think about. You can't go faster than the speed of light in a vacuum, but you can go faster than the speed of light in a material. Now, if we want to think about it, lambda 0, the wavelength of the light in a vacuum, times the frequency of the light, and for reasons that are sort of beyond me, when we talk about frequency with sound and with strings and things like that, we usually use a symbol F, and when we talk about frequency with light, we usually use the symbol nu. Don't know why, but that's sort of the usual thing. So if you have light traveling in a vacuum, then lambda nu is equal to C. And that actually makes unit sense. Lambda is a length, so that's meters. Frequency is number per second, so meters per second gives you the speed. Or a way to think about it is the wave moves one wavelength in the time that it would take whatever it is to oscillate one period, right? So that would be the equation in a vacuum. In the material, the lambda times nu is equal to the velocity, which is equal to C over the index of refraction. Or another way to think about it is that lambda times n is equal to lambda 0. Is greater than 1 because C is larger than B. So what this says is that
in a material, the wavelength is shorter. You multiply it by the index of refraction to get the wavelength in the band. The frequency with which the electric field oscillates and magnetic field oscillates doesn't change, but the wavelength actually shortens in materials.
Suppose we have some glass. Typically for glass, N is equal to about 1.5. So light travels 1.5 times slower in glass typically than it does in air or vacuum. The index of refraction in a vacuum in air is almost 1, so usually we just consider it to be 1. Let us suppose that we have a wave, an electromagnetic wave, that is incident at some angle onto the surface of the glass, and this is a region of air where N is approximately equal to 1. And let us suppose that somehow I can, as the wave is traveling, I freeze time and I look at where the electric field is strongest toward me or something. But I'll see that there's a periodicity in space. And this distance is one wavelength, one lambda zero, because it's basically the wavelength in the vacuum or in here. Now, as this stuff goes into glass, if I consider
the wavelength has to be shorter. So the wavelength in here is shorter than the wavelength here, but these points have to be the same points for both the wave inside the glass and the wave that's outside the glass. And the way you get that solution
is these waves travel like this, and this distance is 1 lambda. So it's the wavelength in the material.
So if you take the solution for a plane wave and you allow it to enter a material and you have these two different velocity solutions and you constrain these points to be continuous, basically, as you go from one medium to the other, which they would have to be, you end up having this wave move at a different angle than this wave. Does that make plausible sense to you?
Usually you draw it something more like this, where this is the glass, this is the air up here. I guess I probably shouldn't do that. If this light is coming in at a certain angle, and we define the angle typically with respect to the 90-degree line, and we call this the angle of incidence, then this comes out. This angle is the angle of refraction. If you go from low end to high end, then theta sub r is less than theta sub I. Or a way to say it is you are bent.
You are bent toward the normal.
Person next to him hit him. Suppose now we have our same interface where we have air and we have glass. The interface isn't that complicated, it's just like that. But now let's say that, okay, so we have the normal here. This is the normal line to the interface, if you want to think about it. And now what I'd like to do is to have the light coming from this direction. This would be the angle of incidence. But in this case, if you go from high end to low end, not low end to high end like we just did, but high end to low end, so the light's now going in the opposite direction. Then what happens is the light gets bent away from the normal. This is designed for them. I can't show you that. Let's see. That's not so good. Okay, I don't have a good demo for that, I don't think. Trust me. So we can summarize this. It's actually quite analytical. You can actually work it out and find that the index of refraction in one medium, if you're going from medium 1 to medium 2, times the sine of the angle in that medium, the angle of incidence, is equal to the index of refraction 2 times the sine of the angle of refraction. This then has built into it this away and toward the normal. If you're going from a low end to a high end, then you're bent toward the normal, which means this angle is smaller. And if you're going from high end to low end, then this angle gets bigger, we're going to wait for more. And that's actually all set up here with the signs. This particular quantitative relationship is known as Snell's Law. Of refraction. And in essence, this is what makes all lenses work. It's what makes glasses work, microscopes work. Everything is basically built on this. Now you might have a medium that's perfectly reflective. I don't know if you can see it, but if I were to draw the line at right angles here, the angle that you have incoming and the angle you have outgoing relative to that 90 degree line is the same for reflection. So if this is sort of a reflecting surface, here's my normal. This is theta incidence. This is theta reflection. Then theta incident is equal to theta reflection. And this is called the law of reflection. Have you ever noticed that I take something and I put it in? It's not very exciting, is it? Never mind. So the law of reflection is intuitive. You notice it when you're looking at mirrors and stuff. The law of refraction is a little less so. Okay, it causes this light to be dim. So you get a lot of weird effects if you look in a pond, for example, and your eyeball is up here and you're looking at a pond and there's a fish swimming. The rays of light from the fish that reach your eye are bent away from the normal, so they go like that, which means to your eye you perceive the fish to be here. seems like it's much narrower, much closer to the surface. If you're into
bow fishing or something, where you take a bow and arrow with a string on it and you shoot the fish or something, you don't aim at what you see. You have to aim low. Otherwise, if you don't correct for retraction, basically, there's no way you're going to hit the fish. All right, so one more thing on this. Let's suppose that we have N2 up here, N1 down here, and let us say that N1 is greater than N2. So an example of this might be where this is water and this is air, or it could be glass and air, or glass and vacuum, or something like that. And now I'm going to have light traveling from the higher index of refraction to the lower index of refraction, so it's coming like so. That means it gets bent away from the normal. Note that you can get a weird situation. As this angle increases, this angle increases, and this angle is bigger than that one. Which means you will, as you increase this angle of incidence, you will reach an angle where this ray is actually running at 90 degrees right along the surface. And that's known as the critical angle. So when this is at the critical angle, I'll call theta sub c, then this reflected ray runs straight along the surface. So that would be when theta 1 is equal to critical angle, theta 2 is equal to 90 degrees. And what's cool here is if you have an angle of incidence that is any greater than theta sub c, that is, if I have an angle over here, that light is totally internally reflected. Okay? So the critical angle is like the limiting angle under which you sort of have refraction, but you have refraction right along the surface. Okay. And then if you go any bigger than that in terms of the incident angle, from high end to low end, you have total internal reflection. You don't have such a thing if you're going from low end to high end. Right, so if you're going from air to glass, that doesn't happen. But if you're inside the glass or inside the water, and you're shining this light, then there's a maximum angle at which you see that's totally internally reflected. One of the kinds of questions you'll often see asked that sort of gets at this is, imagine that there is, you're looking in a swimming pool, and there's, you know, a gold bar on the bottom of the pool. Okay? Then there is an angle at which, as you walk away from that gold bar, as you move away, the angle of incidence of the light to the surface is increasing that reaches your eye. You will reach a point where that light is at such a big angle, it's internally reflected, and you can no longer see that. Which means, in a sense, your visibility down into the water is limited to some region right around you. because to look any further out, that light is internally reflected. So, okay. I can see you're impressed. It is. I am out of time. I will see you Thursday.